You can't tell the history of America's Dairyland without telling the history of Latinos in Wisconsin. I'm Lee Rayburn, and our next guest is a labor leader and activist. Jesus Salas joins us, and he is a historian. He's the author of his memoir, Obreros Unidos, The Roots and Legacy of the Farm Workers Movement, an activist who led the historic march of Mexican migrants from Wautoma to Madison in 1966. As part of organizing for Wisconsin's first farm workers union. Salas was later a lecturer at UW-Madison and UW-Milwaukee, an appointee to the UW System Board of Regents, and the first Latino CEO of United Migrant Opportunity Services. If you have a question for him and his life's work or a story to share, we welcome you here at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And Jesus, it is a pleasure to have you here. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you very much for the invitation.
I want to start with where we are today with you, because you have worked from outside the system to better migrant farmers and dairy farmers' lives in Wisconsin. You have worked from inside the system to help students and help Latinos across the state. And I'm wondering what you see as our state today and where we find migrant workers in Wisconsin today and how they are faring.
Well, when I'm a third generation migrant worker. My grandfather crossed the Mexican border in 1906, lost a homestead during the Depression, started migrating, showed my dad how to get to Wisconsin. He came here in 1942. My second oldest brother was born here. His younger brother, my Uncle Julian, served with the Red Arrow Division when he signed up for the Selective Service in that year and served in Japan. And the war interrupted the migration, but we joined my father in the early 50s, and for the next 8 years, migrating, journeying up to the Midwest, including the state of Wisconsin. So that was my introduction to the state of Wisconsin back as a child.
And where do you see the fight today that you led for so long here?
Well, in terms of the issues that are going on in our community right now, the thugs that are attacking our community and the ICE attacks on our community, the removing of the so-called, President Trump say, the worst are happening to be our next-door neighbors, relatives of ours, even within our own family that we've been here since 1906, we still include family members who were born across the border, that is, who are not documented, and they continue to suffer the ravages of these attacks that are ongoing presently in our community by the ICE.
But we couldn't have this community, we couldn't have this economy, as I understand it, without migrant farmers. Is that how you see it, Jesus?
Absolutely. When we were migrant workers back in the late 50s, early 60s, when I was a migrant worker, my family was a migrant worker, there were over 100,000 migrants coming into the Midwest, over 15,000 to the state of Wisconsin. And as Wisconsin developed, and you mentioned the dairy industry, but all across rural Wisconsin, I'm talking about Kleiman, I'm talking about Cambria, I'm talking about River Falls, Hartford, Wisconsin, small communities, the processing and canning of the food products that were being processed there with the help of these thousands of migrant workers were feeding the growing Midwestern urban areas. And ever since then, we've been an integral part, not only of the development of that agricultural industry, including the dairy industry here in Wisconsin, but in our contribution throughout the Midwest urban area by feeding them.
I feel as though, Jesus, it's not that dairy farmers in Wisconsin aren't necessarily migrants, because dairy farming is year-round. It is every day, multiple times a day. These are more Latino farmers who work on dairy farms in Wisconsin. And do we still see them as integral to our agriculture economy today?
Absolutely. Laborers that work, as you said, at least twice a day in those dairy farms make up over 50% of the agricultural enterprise. And we're still, I think California has just gone ahead as far as milk production is concerned. but we're still a very vibrant dairy industry, including, of course, cheese making. But Mexicans are still, and many of them, by the way, Lee, are undocumented. They're recently arrived Mexican immigrants. I mean, recently, I mean, in the last couple of decades. I'm talking about my grandfather who came here over 100 years ago. But
Mexican and Latinos in Wisconsin are nothing new. In fact, I think they date back all the way to like the 1880s. They were getting here when European settlers were arriving.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Sergio Gonzalez, a professor at Marquette University, speaks of them. And of course, in our community, we refer to them as Los Primeros, the first ones. And over the weekend, we celebrated the Mexican fiesta. And of course, we honor their contribution, because they were the first to celebrate their presence in the community. And Holy Trinity in the near south side later became Bruce Guadalupe in those early days. And when I moved to Milwaukee from organizing in the fields to carry out the California Great Boycott, it was the Archdiocese at that time had to just open up offices at 524 West National, that is the present Walker Points neighborhood. And working out of there, just down the street, Father Grappi and the commandos were marching from the north side to Allen Bradley, demanding the end of the racism and the hiring of Latinos and the Blacks at that company. And I joined them, and it was just an unforgettable experience with the intersection of the farm workers movement and the Black civil rights movement.
Could we have a farm workers movement today like we did, considering the current political climate that we find ourselves in? Could you pull off today what you were able to succeed in large part with in the 1960s?
Well, there isn't a number. As I said, there were 5,000. Automation has had depleted the number of migrants coming in. Most of the Mexicans and Mexican Americans that are coming into Milwaukee are coming directly from the Texas borderlands, directly to the urban areas. They're not stopping doing field work prior to coming here as we did in our generation, or as the Los Primeros did when they established residency in Walker's Point neighborhood more than 100 years ago.
So migrant workers are not as much of a part of our economy as they were?
We're spread out over to the processing plants in the meat industry and construction and dairy farms. There's not as many field workers that are needed to produce the foods that are being produced here in the Midwest and in the state of Wisconsin. We're now dispersed all over Wisconsin and in urban areas throughout the Midwest.
What about considering your experiences both outside the system to change the system, inside the system to evolve the system, what advice do you have for organizers today who are looking to make the quality of life better for workers in Wisconsin?
Well, we started the organizing not individual heads of household, as I saw when I first came here in the 60s, was the focus of the organizing by the unions. In other words, since the field work was a family workforce, we organized the whole family, and we lived in migrant labor camps. So when I was going into the migrant labor camps to organize farm workers, the whole family would sit around and we'd talk to the whole family, or that is men and women of all ages. So I think that the response or the farm workers union as such was a family made up just like the workforce was. And so that you have the women's movement and the youth movement being part of the union movement. It wasn't separate from it. And I think that was unique when we come to the urban areas and we continue to organize families. One of the experiences, for instance, wherever we journeyed to work, Henry Illinois was our first spot because the asparagus sprout used to come out earlier in spring, the thawing out of the frost would see them emerge. So my dad would put us in Henry, Illinois elementary school. So for 4 years, those years that we picked to harvest asparagus, I was in Henry, Illinois elementary school, and I graduated in 1957. I attended three different high schools. So when I came to Milwaukee, just like I had done, I had left my studies at Oshkosh State when I enrolled after high school. So I enrolled at UW-Milwaukee. And UW-Milwaukee had an enrollment of 25,000 university students, and all the Latinos could sit around one table. And so we started organizing, by the way, because, as I said, we had first been housed at the Archdiocese there, and there the Archdiocese program was attempting to teach recently arrived migrants English. And then when UMass was funded in 1965, United Migrant Opportunity Services, they continued to provide adult basic education. But in order to be a teacher, you needed 4 years of college. So these organizations, UMass and the Spanish Centers and other community organizations, as a family, it started to organize the opening up of the University of Wisconsin, because in order to advance, in order even to learn English, we had to train teachers. And in order to train teachers, we have to have access to UWM. So in between 1967, 68 and 69, whole families, just like we organized in the labor camps, would start picketing the chancellor's office to open up access to the university and to establish what at that time was called the Spanish-Speaking Outreach Institute. So my first lesson would be to any future organizer, don't organize the head of the households. Organize the whole family. Organize the husband, the wife, and the children, and talk to them all at once at what your aims are as far as the organization initiative that you are you bring to them.
You talk about the UW system, which eventually Governor Jim Doyle appoints you as a member of the Board of Regents there for the UW system. What was your work like inside the system to try to evolve the system? How did you operate once you got inside the UW?
Well, I had learned one more aspect in there in terms of the university system, because when I graduated several years later, I enrolled at UW-Madison. So I had an idea of what not only the two doctoral institutions in the state, UWM and UW-Madison. And UW-Madison, because of these focus on academic programs and such, we were demanding for them to provide academic courses that reflected the lived experiences of the Latinos, of the Mexican-American and other diverse groups within our community. And that took almost 12 years. So it wasn't until they were very resistant to, the University of Wisconsin, it was a great place to be in, but they didn't like to be told what academic courses should be taught. So it took us a long time to establish that. So that experience also gave me a different view of just the differences of our campuses. That is UWM, I had been to Oshkosh State College right after high school, and now later at UW-Madison. So when I sat at the Board of Regents, I had a very basic knowledge as to what the diversity of the institutions that made up at that time the UW system. So I attempted to, for instance, at that time the whole issue of the undocumented. When we came here, there was no distinction between being documented and undocumented in the fields or in the factories. But when we got to the university, at that time the undocumented were being charged out-of-state students. So when I went and talked to the chancellors, I say, hey, you guys provide scholarships for out-of-state tuition for your athletes and some of the scholars that you want to bring into these great institutions. Why can't you do it to qualified undocumented students? So that was one of the focuses that I wanted to work with. As far as the two major doctoral institutions, to allow all of our students, all of our qualified students, documented and undocumented. And it was really a challenge. But I resigned from the UW Regents in order to carry out what we call the in-state tuition for the undocumented Governor Doyle had difficulty getting one of the houses in the legislature to pass the in-state tuition for the undocumented. So I joined Voces de la Frontera, and I thought I'd do a more effective job in working in the streets, or that is working with the individual legislators. And we finally passed it in 2008, only to be rescinded by Governor Walker when he rescinds our right to organize by passing Act 10. So I come out of retirement and start working and trying to get rid of the governor and reinstate the in-state tuition.
Jesús Salas, our guest, Wisconsin labor activist, historian, his memoir, Obreros Unidos, The Roots and Legacy of the Farm Workers Movement. You can join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can send an email to talk@wpr.org. You mentioned Act 10, Jesús, and I would like to know from your perspective how you see the organized labor movement as it stands today, and the rights of workers in Wisconsin.
Well, the Act 10 displaced, denied over 170,000 public employees here in the state of Wisconsin the right to bargain collectively for their wages and working conditions. But it goes further than that in terms of its negligible, its dramatic negative effects on the core of teachers here, because a lot of the teachers who had been paid and were waiting for their pensions or had to take a shot at losing their health and hospitalization resigned earlier, that is, left their teaching corps. And ever since then, there's been a disruption in terms of these older teachers leaving early, earlier than they thought, just simply to have access to their pensions and to their health and hospitalization. And a lot of new teachers that are coming in and then facing the last 15 years of the Republican legislature that refuses to fund our public schools and the whole charter movement that takes money from public funds to our public institutions, starts giving it to charter schools and just puts us in a horrible position. It's still going on to this day. We still haven't resolved those issues that were initiated by Act 10. Just a disaster. And of course, the issue is coming up before the Wisconsin Supreme Court later on. And it's not going to be the easiest thing, even if they do resolve to give us the right to collective bargaining, starting all over again, just like the farm workers did when they attempted to organize their rights to collective bargaining. The new public school system faculty members and staff are going to attempt to establish their own rights to sit down with the employers, the school boards, and attempt to negotiate collectively once again.
But from the perspective of those that you disagree with, perhaps in the state legislature, do you see an argument that they would make on behalf of school choice for parents as a way of expanding the charter school system? Do you see the argument that was made over Act 10 that it could provide for more affordable state legislature or state budget?
I see very little collaboration with their thoughts, even within with our own community, because I have that same discussion with those individual Mexicans or Mexican Americans, Latinos who belong, are very strong Catholics or are very strong, belong to different religious groups that are not taking funds to initiate these charter schools. I don't think some of them are very successful at this, or that is, have very high rates of their children graduating from their high schools that go on to post-secondary educational institutions, but many don't, and it's just. I think they take money from the public institutions, and they don't really do the job we were attempting to do in the public system. So neither of us are serving our students, whether it's Latinos in charter schools or Latinos in the public education. There isn't the funds to be able to fund both of them. We have to make a decision, and we're going to be faced with one once we decide what to do with the surplus. That surplus money has to be going to those public schools. Look at where that money is going to go. It's going to be going to special needs. It's going to be going to those needs that have been unattended for years in our public schools, our bilingual education, our English learners. Those needs have not been met. And here we're having demands by the charter schools. Yes, I understand. Some of them are successful, but not all of them. And we have to decide what we're going to do with that situation.
Let's take a call.
It's a problem that we're facing, Lee. It's not a problem that has been solved. No.
Thank you. Pardon me. Thank you for that. Jesus Salas, our guest. Let's go to Jack at Madison next. Hi, Jack.
Hey, Lee. Hey, Zeus. You know, it's been interesting hearing you guys talk about, you know, recent plight of farm labor in our state. I heard you guys just talking about the dairy industry. And, of course, we all know what would Wisconsin be if not for dairy. And it got me thinking. My dad happens to know the executive director of the Wisconsin Cheesemakers Association, and we've been hearing stories about, you know, the administration's crackdown on farm labor and how, you know, dairies in our state have taken a hit. And I wondered if Jesus might be able to speak to fight about farm labor, especially in the dairy industry, or what some of the statistics from that might have been.
Jesus, do we know how many workers we've lost as a result of concerns over immigration enforcement from the Trump administration and what that may do to things like our cheese economy?
I don't know specifically how it relates to that particular industry. I know that some of the individuals that are responding to, I understand that there's close to 700,000 deportees already. Since the ICE crackdown on our community started. There's around 65,000 detainees in the detention center throughout the United States, and the arrests are almost the equivalent, the ongoing arrests are almost the equivalent of the number of deportees, but they don't jive because a lot of the detainees in this new detention center don't tell the whole story because some of them are being detained in local law enforcement systems. Now, I do know the impact that they're having on the industry because now it is not just the agricultural industry. There are some of the individuals in construction that are on their own, silently approaching the present administration and saying, hey, ease up, because we don't have enough people to be able to sustain this housing law that just passed. And we don't have the workforce in the construction with all of the deportees that you're having and that impact. So it's not just agricultural. Is now it's going into the construction industry. This right here in Chicago and in the Ohio state, we're hearing that the Haitians who had been getting temporary status, their impact on the health industry and of the caring for the ages. Some of those individuals in those industries are saying, wait a minute, do not get rid of all these individuals. You're going to impact the care of the health services for this group and that group. So people are finally starting to realize the contribution of these families on other industries. And I'm sure if the ICE were to focus on the dairy industry, they would be the dairy farmers who would be the first one to be heard. I know I've met him in advocating for a different legislative initiative that would maintain their workforce stable. They've been at the state capitol along with Voces de la Frontera, the immigrant rights group, and alongside some of us that are advocating for a fair legislative initiative federally. So I'm sure that it would have an impact. I haven't heard that they're impacting the dairy industry to this time.
Jesus, I apologize. We're going to have to leave it there, but I would like to invite you back. I feel like we've got a lot more to talk about on this, and you'd be a perfect person to speak with.
Thank you very much, and thank you for the invitation, especially following Jacqueline and that dramatic story that he told us about the eight-hour workday. I was very moved by that.
Jesus Salas, labor activist and historian in Wisconsin.